Well, good morning. It probably wasn't smart to start off with this picture because I'm already going to lose the audience. You're going to be thinking about eating for the rest of the time. But I like food, and I think that's pretty common in our culture. Americans are kind of known for that, that we like food and we eat a lot. With this picture, I don't know if you guys have had it. I do like the fried egg on a burger. That's a nice touch. It's a nice little addition to it. When you think about food, there's a lot of things you can think about. You can think about your favorite foods. You can think about the foods you don't like. When I go on vacation, one of my favorite things to do is try new foods. That's pretty much what a vacation is, just going and eating in a different place. And that's something that that we enjoy doing. But did you know that there is actually theological significance to a meal? We often think of meals as just something that you need to do to get through the day, or as something that you can enjoy doing because it tastes really good. We often think of it in terms of pleasure or in terms of necessity, kind of depending on how you live. But as you read through the Bible, so much of the Bible and so much of the story of the Bible is actually shaped by meals, perhaps more than we often think about. The biblical story in many ways centers around a meal. The picture of heaven is often a picture of us sitting around a table having meals. Meals play a really important part in the biblical story, and they played an important part of the life and ministry of Jesus. Jesus often had meals with people. We're about to begin a series of lessons where we are walking through the Gospel of Luke, looking at 10 different meals that Jesus had. Some of them are very explicit. Some of them are kind of implied meals, saying he was a guest at someone's house, and you can assume a meal was had there. But that's different than the other Gospels. Jesus has some meals in all of the Gospels, but Luke seems to really focus on that. And a lot of the teaching of Jesus that you get in other Gospels, in Luke, when you get that same teaching, it's centered around a meal. And I think that's important, and I think that's something that we could learn a lot from. And so we're going to begin a series of lessons looking at meals in the Gospel of Luke. But to start off, I was just going to talk about meals in general and some of the meaning and significance that you learn about having a meal with respect to what the Bible says. The meal matters. It's not just another obligation in the day, and it's not just a selfish way to get something tasty in you. The meal actually does have real value and meaning for the life of the church and the life of the Christian. God created this world, and one of the things that is important to know about Christianity and Judaism and the Bible is that creation is a good thing. Sometimes there are like Gnostic views that developed after the start of Christianity that kind of mingled together with Christianity that in essence denied the goodness of creation. They thought, well, spiritual things like immaterial souls, those are good, but the physical stuff all around us, that is corrupted and that is evil. And so the goal is to escape the physical world and to become part of the spiritual or something like that. And sometimes that does influence our even thinking as Christians. But it's really an important point to note, and it'll help you understand the Bible a lot better to know that, no, actually creation itself is good. When God created the world there in Genesis, he ended it by saying, and it was very good. The idea of eternal life is not that we shed our bodies behind and we finally get to go live as a soul that's escaped the prison of our body. No, in Christianity, it's the doctrine of the resurrection, where your body comes back to life. Bodies matter, and creation matters. And that means the things that we do in our bodies are good. Christianity is not an ascetic religion, meaning it's not all about the denial of the body. There are some who have taken it that direction, and they think that things like sex are bad or good food are bad. That's not Christian teaching. Each of those things have proper avenues in which they could be enjoyed. Each of those things have parameters and instructions so that they don't become sinful things. Like food is a wonderful thing, but it can turn into selfishness. It can turn into gluttony. It can turn into one person getting all the food and someone else has none. And it can become a problem. Sex obviously can become a problem. Like so many aspects of life in our bodies can become problems, but none of them are intrinsically problems. Intrinsically, God created them as good things to be enjoyed. And the meal is one of those things. I mean, going back to the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden, we don't have a ton of details about it, except we know they ate well. We know that there were tons of plants and trees that were good to the eye, or that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. That's the description of what it was. And God wanted them to have good, tasty food there. He wanted them to have plentiful food. And yet, the biblical story kind of ends up taking a negative turn when the meal goes wrong. They eat from the wrong tree. It's like from the very beginning, the meal plays an important part of this story. And that idea continues. Think about significant days in Jewish history. Think about the Passover, when they're slaves in Egypt. And of all the things they could be doing the night before they escape, what did God want them to have? A big meal. It's like you would think, no, we'll just eat some, you know, Hot Pockets on the way out the door or something. No, we have other things to do. But no, God wanted them to have a meal, and it became a memorial, a meal that they had over and over and over again. You could think of in the manna. What was one of the big problems? And they were actually wanting to go back to Egypt because of it. It was they didn't have enough food. And so what did God miraculously do day after day for them? He gave them food. Like food was a sign of God's love and provision for them. And it had a really important meaning. You know, one of the things that's incredible about the manna is that you were not supposed to store it up. When you go grocery shopping, when you go to Costco, the goal is to store up so that you have food for a good long time. That was the opposite of the goal with the manna. The goal with the manna was for you to have just enough to get through the day. And then when you went to bed that night, you had nothing. You had nothing else to eat. Every night, children were being tucked into beds with nothing to eat the next day. And parents had to go to bed simply trusting that God would provide again. And that God would provide again. And that was supposed to implant a message into the minds of the Israelites to trust God every single day for what you need. The manna was a spiritual message, and it was a message that came in the form of a meal. The Israelite sacrifices. You know, if you read through Leviticus, you realize there's a lot of different sacrifices, and there are some of them, like the burnt offering, that were not a part of the person who offered it did not eat. But most of the sacrifices, that's just cooking meat. Like, you get a fire, you put the animal on it, and you cook it. And then what do you do with cooked meat? You eat it. The priest would eat some, the person who offered it would eat some, and some parts of it would be left on the altar and burned up to God. And it was kind of like this communal meal, where the person offering got a really good meal, and the priest got a meal, and God got his meal. And the sacrifices were actually a picture of a meal that you were sharing with God and with the priest. The food laws of Israel. Think about how many laws dealt with food and dealt with what you ate and didn't eat and what animals you could eat and what animals you could not eat. Every meal, when you're eating a particular food instead of another food, is a reminder of holiness. God wanted them to remember that they live in the presence of a holy God, and these meals that they're eating are a reminder of the presence of God among them. It's like God was able to often put messages into the food, whether it's the manna in the wilderness, teaching them to rely on God, the sacrifices, where they have communal meals and peace offerings with God, the food laws, where they remember the holiness of God, certain feast days, where they remember the great acts of God throughout history. Throughout the history of Israel, God was active and powerful, whether you're talking about Passover, whether you're talking about these Purim, which we're going to study Esther soon, and that's a big feast day that the Israelites celebrate, and then they remember and read the book of Esther. But Israelites gathered together for feasts regularly throughout the year, and one of the reasons they did that was because meals had memories associated with them. And you would eat a meal in memory of the great things that God has done. One of my favorite stories about a meal comes from the book of 2 Kings, where Elisha is the prophet of Israel, and there's this king, the king of Aram, and he has his army, and they keep attacking Israel, but every time they try to attack Israel, Israel's already aware of the attack, and so they're able to avoid it, and he's getting really frustrated. He begins to suspect that one of his closest inner circle companions is a traitor. And he says, all right, which one of you is spilling the beans? Which one of you is telling our secret strategies to the king of Israel so that they're always prepared? And what you come to find out, and this is what they tell him, none of us are traitors. They have this prophet. And he can tell the king of Israel, he can prepare the Israelites for even the things you're thinking about in your very own bedroom. And so the king comes up with this plan. He thinks, okay, well then instead of attacking Israel or their king, I'm going to attack the prophet. Which, by the way, you would also think the prophet would be aware of that. But that's his strategy. And so he gets his armies and he surrounds the village where Elisha is. And Elisha's servant wakes up one day and he goes outside to get the paper or something. And he looks around and he sees this army that's surrounding him. And he's terrified and he runs back in and he tells Elisha, Elisha, we're undone. We're surrounded. They're going to kill us. And Elisha says, Lord, open his eyes. Those who are with us are greater than those who are with them. And when they look outside, they see not only are the armies of Aram around them, but the armies of God and chariots of fire are surrounding the mountains all around them. Like, even though it looks like they're alone, God is very aware and God is very present. The prophet did know what was going on. And then God does something. He strikes that army blind. You might be wondering why I'm bringing up this story in the context of a meal. Well, it continues. He strikes the army blind, and Elisha goes out there to him. And he's like, oh, I know who you're looking for. Follow me. And he leads this blind army. They're all scared, and they can't see, and they don't know who they're following. They don't know who to trust. And he leads them right to the capital city. He leads them right to where the king is. And he tells the king, I present to you the armies of Aram, surrounded, helpless, in your midst. And the king is ecstatic. And he says, can we kill him? Can we kill him? It's like he is wanting to annihilate his enemies right now. And what Elisha says to do instead is throw them a feast. We're going to have a meal together. And you know what? They have a meal with that army. When their eyes are opened and they begin to see again, it's like they're like, oh no. But then they find out, hey, they're actually taking care of us right now. And then they leave, and it says, and the armies of Aram did not continue to attack the armies of Israel. A meal brought about peace. I think God communicates in meals, and all of these are Old Testament things, and they're all really powerful and good ideas because God still is communicating these same types of truths into the New Testament. But as you get to the New Testament, you see that meals matter a lot as well. How was it that God communicated to Peter that the gospel was for Gentiles also? He has visions of a meal with unclean foods that it's come down, and Peter's like, I'm not going to eat that. And he has to be told in this heavenly vision multiple times, rise, Peter, kill and eat. Don't call unclean what God has cleansed. Be thankful for what you have. Accept what you have. Don't call it unclean. All food is good, provided it is eaten with thanksgiving in the heart. Like, all of these messages are communicated through the offering of food. Paul and Peter end up having an early controversy. In fact, several early Christian controversies surrounded the idea of food. Peter had been eating with Gentiles, which was a big thing. You know, Jews tended to not do that. But then when some Jews from Jerusalem came, he didn't want them to see him doing that. So he stopped eating with Gentiles and would only eat with the Jews. And Paul saw him doing this. And he rebuked him to his face and said that you're actually no longer walking down the street of gospel truth anymore. You have turned aside from gospel truth. Why is that? Because part of the gospel is the uniting together of Jews and Gentiles into one family. And the key picture of that unity is the meal. So when you make two tables and you say, them Gentiles eat at that table and the Jews at this table, you're actually harming the gospel itself. So Paul sees the meal is actually a central image of what the gospel is doing. The dietary laws that we talked about in the Old Testament, those created controversies in the New Testament. What about like in the end of the book of Romans, chapter 14? I think that's largely what the conversation is about. There are a number of Jew-Gentile issues that are brought up. But what about foods that I think are unclean and foods that you think are clean? And can we find a way to work this out to where we could sit down and have a meal together? And that's what Paul, throughout Romans 14, is trying to get the church to be able to do, to have a meal together. Accept the one who the Lord has accepted. Sacrifice to idols. That's a big question that came up. all right, what about if I'm going to have a meal with someone, but I know they got this meat from the marketplace, and I know what happens at the marketplace in Corinth. When they cook meat there, just like the Israelites, we talked about their animal sacrifices, they would cook the food, and some of it would go up to their god, and some of it they would eat, and some of it the priest would eat. The pagan priests did the same thing. Like, part of the food would go up to their god, and then they would cook it, and the people would eat the other one. And the question becomes, can I eat meat that was sacrificed to an idol, or if it's sacrificed to a god that I don't believe in? And that's a big question. And that's the way you buy meat at the marketplace. And Paul ends up giving a number of practical suggestions for how to navigate this. What he says basically is, don't go to a pagan temple and eat a meal there. That would be fellowshipping with idols. Do not do that. If you go to someone's house and they're serving you meat, don't ask any questions. I love that advice. Sometimes just don't ask about it. Just eat it and be thankful. You don't need to know more than that. But don't invite someone over with meat sacrificed to an idol and then tell them, and if they're uncomfortable, try to pressure them into eating it. That wouldn't be acting out of love. And so he gives a lot of ways to navigate it. But all that, there are multiple chapters in multiple books of the New Testament just trying to figure out the dynamics of having a meal together. Why? Because the meal matters. The meal was central to fellowship. In fact, that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that's one of the reasons Paul says don't go to a pagan temple and eat the sacrificed meat there, because you would be having fellowship with them. Just like if you went to the temple in Jerusalem and ate the meat there, that's an act of fellowship. And we have an act of Christian fellowship, a meal that we have with one another. It's a bloodless sacrifice, but it's one that remembers and honors the blood of Christ, and we actually just took it. That's a fellowship meal. The Lord's Supper is... I mean, when you think of all the things that Jesus could have given us, that he said, I want this to be a reminder of my sacrifice on the cross. It could have been, why don't you go ahead and read Matthew every week as a collection of people? Granted, I realize Matthew was written a little bit later, but the point is, he could have said, read scripture. He could have said, tell stories about it. He could have said, reenact it in a drama. Like, he could have said a bunch of things, but what did he give his disciples? He gave them a meal. He says, I want you to remember this meal, and I want you to have this meal with each other, and I want you to come together regularly and share this meal. On the first day of the week, the early church gathered together for that meal. And yes, they sang songs, and they worshiped, and they taught scripture, and they did a lot of things, but it centered around this collective meal, this communal meal that they had with one another. And I believe that that is rooted in the teaching and in the example of Jesus. Remember, we're going to begin studying the Gospel of Luke. And so much of Jesus' teaching and interaction in the Gospel of Luke is centered around a meal. One of the things that you should know anytime you read Luke or Acts is those are part one and part two of the same book. And the things that Jesus does in Luke, you see the church begin to do in Acts. You see that with a whole host of different topics. Like, Jesus is the great teacher in Luke, and the church and the apostles become the great teachers in Acts. Jesus is the one who is killed in Luke. The apostles begin to be the ones who are martyred in the book of Acts. And you see, there's a ton of examples you can give where the things Jesus does are now being done by his body. And one of those is meals. The earliest descriptions of what the church was doing, you have words like this. And they were devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Think about those things that are combined there. The apostles' teaching and prayer and fellowship. And we think of these as good Christian things, right? And notice right there in the middle of them, and the breaking of bread. That was a part of it as well. That was a central ingredient to early Christian unity. It says, and day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. So people are being saved, and they're gathering together, and they're having meals with each other in each other's houses. They're doing this day by day, and as they do so, they are being pure and sincere in their heart, but they're also being generous, sharing their food with other people. Like, this is a demonstration and a proclamation to the rest of the world that something powerful is happening when you have people who otherwise would never eat together because of Jesus are now sitting around the same table. There are many benefits that come from Christians eating together. There are benefits that come from eating people, eating, eating with people. In a lot of different circumstances, just like your family itself. I don't know that there is more valuable family time that can be spent than when you're gathered together around a table. And I would encourage families not to get so busy that you can't sit with each other around a table and have a meal with each other. That is a wonderful time for conversation. It's a wonderful time to know what's going on in each other's lives. It's a wonderful time to prioritize time with another person. But meals together, when you invite someone into your home, they're also a wonderful time for communal prayer. What I mean is, when you have someone in your home and you're sitting around a table and you're having a meal, how do just about every one of those meals start? You say a prayer. And you usually pray for the guests that are there with you, and you pray and you thank God for the food. But it's a way of gathering together with other people, talking to God and inviting Him to be a part of this moment in this relationship. Meals have a way of inviting God to do that when we begin them with prayer. It's a way of prioritizing others. You know, when we have people at our house, it usually takes time cleaning, time preparing a meal. It takes doing quite a few things to prepare for that. And why are you doing those things? Because you want these people to feel welcomed in your house, and you want them to feel comfortable in your house, and you want them to know that you care about them. And having meals with another person is a way of demonstrating to them that you care about them. It's an act of generosity when you share your food and you share your time and you share your table with another person. It's a way of removing barriers. The more time that we spend separate and apart with our walls of our house keeping us from the walls of someone else's house, and we spend our time away from each other, it's very easy to have both natural, physical, but then also spiritual barriers that begin to grow in our lives. But you'd be amazed how those barriers begin to tumble when we enter one another's doors, we sit with one another at a table, we talk with one another. It opens up the door to a closeness and to an intimacy that otherwise is really, really hard to ever reach or ever share. Having meals together knocks down the barriers that keep us secluded from one another. A lot of meals end up becoming times of fun and laughter too. Just sheer enjoying time with another person. You tell stories with other people. You tell jokes with other people. You learn more about another person. And usually that comes with good memories and laughter and fun being shared. It's a way of building unity. And I also believe it is a strategy, if that's the word you want to use. If you want the church to grow, if you want to have people who are connected to the church, if you want to have visitors come back to the church, if you care about the future of the church, one of the best things you could do is invite someone to your home for a meal. People are much more likely to come back when they have been in someone's home. And by the way, if you're a member, you're much more likely to feel connected to others and connected to the body when you have been with each other, not just in here, but in someone's home. You can get creative with a lot of church growth strategies, and some of them are interesting, and some of them are helpful and good. But I do think sometimes the simplest things are the best things you could do. Talk to someone, introduce yourself to someone, invite someone out to eat, or even better, invite someone into your home to eat. And each of those types of things will make connections that can help build relationships and strengthen the church for many, many years. And so, as we bring our lesson to a close, we are going to be studying the Gospel of Luke. We're going to be looking at the meals that Jesus has. He has meals with his disciples. He has meals with Pharisees. He has meals with people who don't like him. He does all kinds of things at these meals. But he goes and he makes an impact. And it shaped the life of the early church, who, in imitation of Jesus, continued the ministry of meals. So, as we bring our lesson to a close, here's the challenge. Invite someone or a family into your home for a meal, whether it's a visitor or another member or someone else who worships here. Try to do that. And I'm not saying it has to be done this week, but pick a date on a calendar and see if you can get someone into your home for a meal. It will take work. It will take some preparation. It will take generosity. It will take prioritizing that person and time. But I think you'll find that if we can get into a habit of doing that, it'll be a blessing to everyone involved. If there's anyone here this morning who maybe your life has taken a turn that you never thought that it would. Maybe sin has become something that you find to be a regular part of who you are, and you would like the help and the prayers of the church. We would love to help pray for you, encourage you, strengthen you in any way that we can. And if there's anyone here who would like to become a Christian, having your sins washed away in baptism, naming Jesus as Lord of your life, and preparing for that meal in the age to come, where we will sit around a table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the presence of the Lord. That's available to you. You can take part in that. You can enjoy that. You can have a glimmer of that even in life right now as we gather together and have meals with one another. If you want to become a Christian, please let that be known. Come sit on the front row or talk to one of our elders in the back while we stand and as we sing.